slowly over time, as I got older, I realized that I didn't want to have kind of something that was deeply a part of me around giving back to be a side project and what I did in my personal life. And I really wanted to begin to have those things to come together as one.
Welcome to Fresh Take, a candid interview series featuring thought leaders and innovators from across the Capital Region. These one-on-one conversations highlight the incredible work happening in our communities and showcase both where we are and where we are going as a region.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us for today's Fresh Take. My guest today is Ellis Carr. Hello, Ellis.
Hey, JB. Good to be with you today.
Thanks. It's great to talk to you again, and great to have you on. Folks, just a little bit about Fresh Takes and the partnership. The partnership is a group that was formed to advance regional interests in the region from Baltimore through Richmond. We focus on a few different topics, in particular, expanding, broadening, and deepening the digital talented skills pipeline is one. Transportation and mobility is another. And what we're calling inclusive growth is a third. We have a view that inclusion is the new innovation, and the region that is that becomes the most inclusive and equitable will be the fastest growing region in the country because it will do the best for the people here and also be the most attractive region in the world. So that's a little bit about us. And in that context, I'm really happy to have the chance to talk with Ellis about his work, about the region, about CDFIs, et cetera. Let me start by giving you a little bit of background about Ellis. Ellis has more than 20 years of experience in the financial services and mortgage industries. He started when he was 12. He served as Capital Impact Partners President and Chief Executive Officer, and he served in that capacity since 2016. He started with the group in 2012 as CFO and treasurer. Prior to that, Ellis worked across the investments, capital markets, strategy, and corporate finance areas within Freddie Mac and in fixed income fund management, both domestically and abroad at Deutsche Bank. Ellis is an Aspen Institute Finance Leader Fellow, serves on Morgan Stanley's Community Development Advisory Board. He's the board chair for Martha's Table and board treasurer for HPN, the Housing Partnership Network. In 2018, he was recognized on Washington Business Journal's list of top minority business leaders, as well as being named among their top 40 under 40 business executives. Ian, I won't mention the name there, the year, Ellis. There we go.
Appreciate that.
He's also been directly helpful with us on our inclusive growth committee in helping us understand what a strategy around inclusive growth for the region should mean and where are the gaps that the partnership generally can help accelerate filling. So, Ellis, thank you for that and welcome.
Thanks, JB.
Let's start a little bit by talking about you and your journey. I just read some of the bios, but maybe talk a little bit about how you came to Capital Impact Partners, because it's a little bit, if you will, it's kind of a subcategory of work in financial service. It's a little different than Deutsche Bank. Let me put it that way.
It is. No, I really appreciate having the opportunity to be here with you, JB, and look forward to the conversation. Maybe I'll just start by saying that my journey was heavily influenced by my parents, who were both DC public school teachers here for nearly 30 years each. And, you know, over the course of their work life as teachers, you know, they made the choice explicitly to work in some of the most underserved areas in DC. And they made that decision because they understood that oftentimes opportunity was limited because of where you lived. And in other instances, opportunities were limited to folks because of their own circumstance. So they spent a lot of their time and their careers coaching, encouraging, and supporting students because they believed that everyone had deserved access to quality education. And most of all, that everyone deserved to feel like their community cared about them and was invested in their success. So that really had a big impression on me as a kid, seeing how the students responded to my parents and really helped to reiterate or underscore in me that I was part of a much larger community that I needed to have concern over as well. And so really, I think initially, I would say that because of that, I grew up thinking I was going to be an educator. And my parents told me not to do that to get another job. And so after a lot of trial and error, I landed on really pursuing a degree in finance and accounting, going into undergrad. And my mother was a math teacher. And so probably, my decision was also influenced by the fact that, all the work that she had me doing on spring break and all the breaks to keep me busy, made me realize I was pretty good at, with numbers and math as well. So, so that was really kind of how I kind of came to this work, kind of, and made my way into Deutsche Bank and Freddie Mac, as you mentioned before coming to Capital Impact. I think it's interesting to note that, you know, in my early part of my career, probably for the first decade or so, I kind of kept church and state pretty separately, meaning work was about work and, and delivering resources for myself and my family and making a living, while I always had a connection to community, whether that was through my church or through social organizations. I was always kind of giving back in different ways. And I think slowly over time, as I got older, I realized that I didn't want to have kind of something that was deeply a part of me around giving back to be a side project and what I did in my personal life. And I really wanted to begin to have those things to come together as one. And so, interestingly enough, it was my work through the community that actually, brought the opportunity with Capital Impact, before me. So really happy to have joined in 2012. And as you mentioned, was elevated to president and CEO in 2016 and haven't looked back.
That's great. Thanks very much. I think that talk about the community connection is interesting as we talk about what CDFIs are and what they do. Let me come to that in just a second. But you're a long-term denizen of the region. This is a broad question, and I didn't let you know I was going to ask it. So here you go. But how has the region changed, good and bad, since you were a kid here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I'll give you a couple of anecdotes. My wife is also from the region as well, and she chose to go away to school, both for undergrad and graduate school. And one of the reasons that she left was because she felt like this wasn't a real city. And the city was really more public sector focused. She didn't think that there was a lot of opportunity. Naturally, she moved back, as a lot of my friends and family did, because D.C. underwent a rapid period of growth in the private sector, and the emergence of kind of biomedical, biotech organizations, and a number of other medical organizations. So I think really this region is really grown in terms of the kind of eds and meds perspective, since I was much younger. I think the other part I'd say, JB, is right. Demographically, the region has changed quite dramatically. When I was growing up, DC was affectionately known as Chocolate City. And some might argue that that's changed, quite a lot. And it's probably no longer known as that. And so, not only has racial demographics changed, but so have income demographics has changed as well. We know that this is a extremely kind of rich in resources region, both in terms of people and institutions. And I would say one of the things where we find ourselves today around the focus around inclusive growth is the fact that growth has not been equivalent across kind of the demographic landscape. And that's not necessarily solely focused on this region. We're seeing this kind of on a national scale and actually on a global scale. So a lot of really good things have happened. And I think there's a conscious effort now to really think about how that growth and opportunity can be made available to more people.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you for that, Ellis. Let's talk a little bit about CDFIs. What are they? For an audience that may not understand the financial system, maybe talk a little bit about, what they are, the role that they play, and then we'll go for that. I got a couple of follow-ups on that too.
Sure. So CDFIs, or community development financial institutions, are private sector mission-driven financial intermediaries whose primary purpose is to expand economic opportunity for low-income people and communities. Prior to coming to Capital Impact, I didn't know what a CDFI was. It's an acronym that's, I think, becoming more and more known today, particularly in these times in the last year. They're a vital part of the financial ecosystem. And so CDFIs can be structured as banks or credit unions or loan funds, which Capital Impact is, or venture capital providers. And typically you will see them really embedded in communities, which are and focused on supporting businesses, investing in schools or local healthcare centers or community centers, all in efforts to provide and create opportunity for their residents. When you think about where CDFIs are in kind of the financial landscape, they really play a role in communities that oftentimes kind of mainstream banks and financial institutions can't play and don't play because they, I would say the one of the key benefits for CDFIs is that because they're embedded in communities, they understand, or we understand, the real the delineation between real and perceived risk, right? Because a lot of the work that we do in underserved or underestimated communities are really transformational in a large degree, because there is a dearth, or there's frankly a non-existence of financial products and support for those communities. And so we have the ability to kind of understand and manage risk appropriately and work with other financial institutions to leverage their capital to provide resources to communities that haven't traditionally had capital invested in them. And so we kind of think of ourselves as kind of a boutique or a boutique type financial organizations that provide tailored solutions for the communities in which we serve. Maybe a couple other things I just mentioned, JB, around our role in the kind of financial ecosystem. I think we play three probably distinct roles. One is really around kind of what we call market makers. And I kind of just spoke to that, creating new products and services in, when there isn't an existence of any. Two, I think we play a role as a market catalyst. And as CDFIs, we form public-private partnerships, which basically leverage, in this case, maybe federal dollars. And for every dollar that we are able to raise, we are able to leverage that with $10 of private sector dollars. So we're able to create those products initially based on the feedback from the community, and then begin to develop public-private partnerships to bring those to scale. And I think the last place that we play, I think, really well in the financial ecosystem is what we call kind of a community quarterback. And that's really an organization who really understands the strategy or the goals and objectives of a community, and can basically play a coordination role, both to provide the resources and the capital to really help that community achieve its desired outcomes.
Yeah, that's great. Ellis, if you can, maybe talk about a client or two. Like, tell us, who should people imagine when they think of the people that you're providing, that you're lending to? A couple of stories on that front would be helpful.
Yeah, and I'll give a couple broad categories, and then maybe speak to one or two. In this region, Capital Impact has played a role in a few different areas. We've primarily focused on a few different sectors: education, healthcare, food, and housing. And so from a housing perspective, we will work with an affordable housing developer that is providing quality and affordable housing to residents that may earn 30 to 50 or 80% of the area median income, but in a place that's safe and affordable, but also proximate to their jobs. We will also have and will continue to provide access to capital for, say, a community healthcare center. And a community healthcare center in this case will provide healthcare services and access to healthcare for those individuals who may be a lower income or uninsured in the district. And an example of that would be like a Unity Healthcare. And finally, you know, we have supported a number of nonprofits who provide really critical safety, kind of safety net services to their communities. And as you mentioned, I'm on the board of Martha's Table here in the city that really helps provide kind of food and education supports for a number of residents in both Ward 8, primarily in Ward 8. And Capital Impact was able to provide financing for their expansion to Ward 8, the Commons, where they're able to actually provide a focused place-based resources for their residents in that neighborhood.
And to some degree, you're arbitraging the risk between the financial institutions, you mentioned the federal government as well, that can provide some of the capital and the use of that capital. And my sense is that in order to do that, you just need to know who you're lending to. And I think you alluded to this really well and work closely with them, which seems very different from the normal big financial institution model that we think about that. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. I mean, what I mentioned, kind of tailored or bespoke kind of approach, you know, some have said that we're very artisanal in that nature because we have to go in and understand the needs of the community and then begin to develop financial products to address their needs. And so the work that we may be doing in Detroit, where we do work, a lot of work, may be very different than D.C. The work that we're doing in D.C. may be very different than the work we're doing in Oakland, et cetera, because we try to take the unique needs and resources within each environment and then to bring those resources together in support of the community.
Yeah, but loan loss, those sorts of things, you know, I'm sure you track those. And can you talk a little bit about, I think the perception again for folks who don't know is that, well, that just must be a highly risky category that, you know, folks are, so they're going to have a lot bigger proportion of write-offs or anything like that. And yet I don't think that's necessarily the case. How do you folks think about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think first and foremost, I think we are a nonprofit, which means that we're not profit maximizing. But we have to be profitable. And the reason that that's an important distinction is that the difference between profit maximizing and profitable really allows for the communities to build capacity and for the businesses, nonprofits, and organizations that we lend and invest in to really begin to develop and create more jobs and support their community more specifically. But we are a financial institution, which means we have to kind of look at and evaluate credit and credit worthiness, just as any other financial institution would. But we also look at and evaluate kind of the social impacts, right? So it's the who and the what is that is being happening, that's happening. So that could be everything from who's leading the organization that we're lending to? Do they have community support? Are they creating jobs? And what are the community benefits of the projects or initiatives that we're supporting? So we still approach our work with a similar rigor of a traditional financial services organization. But again, because we're community-based, our success is really driven by and quantified by how the community benefits from our work. So I think to your point, JB, I think we still have loan losses. Capital Impact is S&P rated, and we issue debt in the public markets to both individuals and institutions. So we have to have the rigor required to be in those markets. But I think having the real understanding of the community really helps us to understand and really cut through the perception around risk. Because as you can imagine, when something is unknown, it is definitely perceived to be more risky. And I think to your point, our loan performance has been extremely stellar, as most CDFIs have been.
That's great. Thanks for that. Let's talk about the impact of COVID, both on your organization, but also more generally on the populations that you're serving through the organization.
Yeah, I mean, as everyone knows, COVID had 2020 was a really tough year for a lot of both people and businesses. And in particular, we've all read about all of the first responders and how they have put their lives on the line in support of others in hospitals and in medical institutions. It has been covered, but probably to a lesser degree, are all the folks who have also are working both hourly jobs and roles in which require them to put themselves in harm's way, and because they don't have the ability to kind of work from home as maybe you or I do. And so, there's a high correlation of folks who are working in those roles who are also lower income individuals. And so we've seen in the communities in which we serve a really distinct and pronounced impact both on the individual people, but also the businesses that are operating in those areas. And so one of the focuses that we have had for some time is really around kind of ensuring that our communities have equitable access to products and services, but also that we have the ability to begin to address kind of the wealth gap that we're seeing in this country, particularly the racial wealth gap. And so as we're looking at the number of businesses that are not expected to survive COVID, there is a significant portion of them that are minority led. And so that's something that is really important to us to figure out how we can be supportive really during this time period. So to answer your question, it's been pretty debilitating for a lot of communities. And our goal has really been around how can we help support the immediate recovery, but then also really help them to get back to a resilient and stabilized community.
Yeah. So sort of the path to inclusive growth is through inclusive recovery. One of the things that's happened recently, you and I've spoken a bit about, is the new legislation to add funding for CDFIs and MDIs. It's you know, roughly $12 billion in total. And to your point about sort of leverageability of that kind of capital, in theory, that could mean, let's call it another $100 billion of lendable capital that might end up being available into the system through CDFIs and MDIs by virtue of that that legislation, which passed at the end of the last calendar year. But from our conversation, it's pretty clear. It's not just a matter of, you know, therefore capital impact and others line up and say, give me $8 billion. It's more is going to have to happen to really put this capital to work in a functional way. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? What are the prospects? Is this $12 billion interesting? What do we have to do to really take advantage of it appropriately?
Sure. So the $12 billion that was a part of the recent stimulus package that was approved in January is pretty incredible for CDFIs and transformational. Prior to this legislation, there was about that funding was just under about $250 million.
Wow.
Looking at a pretty sizable, you know, increase in funding, which is music to our ears and from a CDFI perspective. And just to talk a little bit about why that's relevant, because organizations like Capital Impact and others, CDFIs, because there's no existence of a secondary market in our space. Traditionally, our loans and our investments are portfolioed on our balance sheet. And so that constrains our ability to continue to lend and invest further in communities. So having the ability to have significant availability of dollars to scale up and provide scaled solutions, particularly at this time, is pretty incredible. And we're really excited about it. That said, you know, I think that there are challenges for us as an industry to be able to take that, to be able to utilize those dollars and resources effectively, because we need to continue to find willing partners to partner with us at a time that is particularly troubling from an economic perspective. And so, I think we understand that while these resources are available to us and we'll be competing actively with our other CDFIs across the country to get those resources channeled into this region in particular, we will also need to ensure that we have and are working under a common strategy and partnership with other private institutions who really care about inclusive growth in this region.
What do those private institutions need to do, Ellis? Is it that, you know, the traditional big financial institutions with big balance sheets need to double up, you know, sort of say, great, you know, you take 12, we'll give you 36. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. And I'll take a step back and then answer your question, JB. Capital Impact, as I mentioned, has really been focused on kind of broader community facilities and housing, as I mentioned. And last August, we realized that more needed to be done. And we announced an alliance with CDC Small Business Finance, which is one of the largest mission-based small business lenders in the country. And we did that for a few reasons. But the first one, and most chiefly, is that we really strongly believed in a vision for holistic community and economic development at scale, centered around people and communities. And we realized that we needed to change and pivot the way that around the work that we were doing, because ownership was going to need to be key in any economic recovery. And so CDC Small Business Finance and Capital Impact are working together initially in three specific regions across the country. This is one of them, to really help drive community and economic development at scale. And as we've been talking about the work that we're going to do it together, we recognize that even our own approach and way that we need to provide credit and capacity to communities has got to change, because there is a growing part of the population across the country, and particularly in this region, that has been left out of traditional and mainstream finance. And so to reach them, we can't use the traditional tools that we have been. We'd have to augment them, as similar to my comments earlier, to be able to reach those segments of the market. And so because we are changing and evolving around how we are providing services to our communities institutions, right, need to do the same. And yes, it's about capital, but it's also about understanding and leveraging of their resources, their people resources, to really help provide us capacity as CDFIs, so that we can provide, you know, the best thinking around how to reach the markets that have not been reached, these communities that have not been reached, so that we can move forward as a nation, quite frankly, in a region, to create more opportunity for more people.
One of the we came out with a study this week that our friends at EY helped us pull together about corporations' intentions post-pandemic, and it's pretty clear that those organizations that can intend to be a lot more hybrid in the future than they've been. And for a region like this, that could be good news, because to the degree that it means that you can live anywhere and work anywhere, there are a lot of, you know, living in this region can be great in many ways. But it also has real prospective implications for the ability to recover, particularly in the urban areas. And if you think about the businesses that are going to be most affected by that, they're those that have been the most affected by the pandemic in many ways. You know, it's the sort of small businesses that are very dependent on having a thriving downtown. If you assume those changes, how would that affect your strategy? How would that affect your work in Detroit or DC or Oakland or other areas?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, JB. I think for me, one of the things that we are really focused on is, and it's in partnership with you and your team and with those who are part of the Greater Washington Partnership, is really, it's important for us to understand where the opportunities will exist going forward. And working And having a better understanding of that and and developing a strategy around how to ensure that small businesses, which is a strong driver of the economic engine in this region, continues to prosper, requires us to really have a really strong perspective around where we're headed. And so one of the things that I'm excited about is that we are working to develop that strategy in partnership with you all. And I think if we have an understanding for what success looks like for us, where the next set of jobs will be created, to your point, if they're virtual or not, then we can really help ensure that the workforce has adequate training. Folks are trained effectively for those jobs that we'll need in the next 5 and 10 years, and that we can begin to provide guidance and support that we do today for small businesses so that they can pivot and take advantage of those opportunities. So I think for us, it's not just about financing. It's also getting people prepared and prepared to take on capital, but also prepared to take on the market around them as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting time because I think everyone understands the acuteness of the issue in front of us. And yet, as you mentioned, everyone's also dealing with the sort of train wreck behind them. And it's difficult. Our higher ed partners understand the need to help skill up more now than ever. And yet, that industry as an industry last year was, as set upon as any industry. So strategy is going to be critical, to your point, Ellis, understanding priorities. In that context, if you think about the CDFI, MDI, the sort of the landscape of institutions like yours in this region, you sort of think Baltimore to Richmond, how should people think about that? Are there a lot of them, relatively speaking, here? Are they, relatively mature? Are we overserved, underserved? How do you think about that?
I think that this region is incredibly well served with the CDFIs and MDIs in this region. There are about 1,000 CDFIs across the country operating in every state. And I would say that there are four of the largest CDFIs in the nation operating in this region. You have three also MDIs that operate between Richmond and Baltimore. And so I think that we are incredibly well served from a neighborhood level CDFI all the way to CDFIs like Capital Impact and others that operate nationally but are headquartered here and really kind of care about this work. So the great part about that is that we already collaborate and work well together today. And given the intentional focus that we'll need to provide in this region, I think that is a good foundation for what is to come around how we can plug in and support that broader strategy as it's developed.
Great. We had a question about opportunity zones. Ms. Branham, I won't give it more context other than to say, how do you think about those in the context of your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are, Capital Impact has not leveraged or utilized opportunity zones to date. There are a few CDFIs actually who operate in this area who have opportunity zone funds for investors to invest in. I think for us, we've thought about it as a potential capital source for us to advance the work. But we have not done a lot of work with them.
Great. I wanted to talk, maybe before I do this, let me just a little bit more about Capital Impact Partners. How big is the organization, Ellis? How many folks do you have? How do you talk about it in terms of its financial size, or what are the sort of metrics that you can share about that?
Sure. So Capital Impact, we're a national nonprofit community development financial institution headquartered right here in Arlington, Virginia, but we have offices in New York, Detroit, Austin, and Oakland. So we have just over 100 people working across the country. Probably about a little less than half operating here in this region. We have about $1 billion in assets under management. Some of the metrics that we look at is our kind of our loan portfolio size, which is just under 400 million. Loan performance in terms of credit quality is under 50 basis points in terms of credit delinquencies and credit losses. Actually, last year, delinquencies and credit losses were under 10 basis points.
And that's amazing.
And so, and that's been, it's been consistently about that over the last several years. So we've, again, seen a lot of really strong performance, and we work very closely with our borrowers and investees to make sure that that they're supported. And as a result, we have good portfolio quality as a result.
Yeah. The $1 billion under management and the $400 million, how do those numbers compare to CDFIs around the country? Is it in the top? Are you in the top segment of those?
Sure. Yeah. I would say Capital Impacts is probably in the top five of the 1,000 CDFIs in terms of asset size. We've grown pretty dramatically over the last, we've grown over 50% over the last 4 years. And that was intentional. We wanted to double down in a few areas. DC was one of those areas. And I think with the alliance with CDC Small Business Finance, we have a number of things planned for this year, which we expect that number to grow pretty substantially.
My experience with CDFIs is a lot of them don't grow. A lot of them kind of get stuck. They have certain partners to provide capital and they just sort of stay where they are. What's allowed you to grow, particularly the last 4 years haven't necessarily been the easiest?
Yeah. So I think your initial comment is well placed. And I think it goes back to the access to capital for CDFIs themselves, and the fact that there's no secondary market. So oftentimes liquidity is probably access to capital, specifically equity capital, is what prevents CDFIs from growing. And I think just going back to your earlier question, having the ability to have a significant amount of capital available to CDFIs, particularly the ones that have not been able to grow, provides them an opportunity to grow and invest probably in resources such as technology to really be able to get to a different level of scale. And for Capital Impact, in terms of our growth, you know, we have benefited from public-private partnerships where we've created funds that have invested in healthcare or education or other community-type facilities where we have utilized other people's money and generated fees off of that. And that has allowed us to kind of grow our balance sheet in terms of net income that then could be leveraged over time. And so our growth was really around thinking strategically around growing through partnership and generation of fees while we were able to leverage our great credit quality and invest in ourselves and grow our portfolio.
That's fascinating. You mentioned technology, and then I want to turn to one last category of question as we wrap up here. But there's been a huge explosion in online lending over the last X period of time. And I have to believe that some of those that, for lack of a better term, are targeted by some of those online lenders are folks who historically might have availed themselves of a CDFI or other. And yet, you know, there seems to be nearly usurious interest rates in some of those online. Could you talk a little bit about that phenomenon? And you mentioned technology for CDFIs. I would think competing with that is something they have to think about.
So I think you are exactly right. There are a lot of organizations or companies who need access quickly to capital, and they know that the rates are unusually high or usury. But they need the access. One of the areas that I am thankful for, for the last year is that CDFIs, the brand of CDFIs has raised quite significantly, kind of as a part of the pandemic and the civil unrest. And so I think quite frankly, JB, a lot of people just don't know about that the industry exists. And I think that, the fact that we do not have, as an industry, although they're growing, made investments in technology that are akin to, another fintech, I think does not put us on equal positioning, doesn't put us on the equal ground. And so I'm confident that, because I know that several CDFIs and actually part of a few convenings that I've been to over the last 6 months, technology has been named as like the top area that needs to be invested in. And so as we think about kind of pulling this back to this region, thinking about how we can leverage technology to serve as a conduit to develop pipelines for CDFIs is something that I think needs to be solved for.
Yeah. Well, we should get some of the companies in the partnership to fund internships for folks in our educational establishments from underrepresented groups to work on that problem and then work for you.
That's right. I love that.
Ellis, last question, and thank you again for the time today. You mentioned the wealth gap, and that's something that we talk a lot about. You know, if you look at the data, arguably the region or some of the MSAs in the region have done a pretty good job to some degree closing the income gap over the racial income gap over the last 20, 30 years. But the wealth gap persists, and if anything, it's broadened. What do we need to do to close that? Because I thought I'd ask the easiest question for you last.
Absolutely. So I think there's two ways that have historically created wealth in this country. One is through homeownership, and the other is through business ownership. And I think that those really are the two areas that I think we can and should focus on, given the strength of this region, and the institutions that are operating within it. I think there's a huge, and the federal government, there's a huge opportunity to really kind of create pathways to moving those entrepreneurs that are 2 to 3 people up to 25 to 30 people. And I think if we can continue to be very thoughtful about how we go about that, I think we'll see business ownership rise. I think to your other point earlier around how the pandemic has accelerated innovation and how that is going to change the way that we operate and work gives an opportunity to really think broadly about the region and allow people who may be within plus or minus 5 miles from the city center to really actually move a little bit further out where they can actually afford to buy a home and generate wealth. And so I think that there are ways that we can help support that, both indirectly and directly for all people in the region.
That's great. And one of the things I think too, that's a good, is a great point. I think we'll end this, Ellis, but your point about supporting entrepreneurs that may be 2 or 3, people in a group to, even call it 10 times of that. I think as we think about entrepreneurship, it's just so important that everybody understands that all kinds of businesses have an entrepreneurial element. It doesn't all have to just be the next Snapchat.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I think we can't underestimate either, right? The fact of those small businesses are in a community, and they're oftentimes investing in that community themselves. So it has a ripple effect in terms of how wealth is created, how resources are generated in that community as well.
Yeah. Well, my guest today has been Ellis Carr, who's the CEO of Capital Impact Partners. Very fortunate to have your group headquartered here, Ellis. I wanted to thank you for all the work you folks are doing, but also for the partnership with the partnership as we work on this critical strategic issue, which is making sure this is the most inclusive growth region in the country. Ellis, thanks for all that you do, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks, JB. Great to be with you.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks for tuning in to Fresh Take. This episode was produced by Jenna Klein, Francesca Iofrida, Ian Lutz, Nina Sharma, and Justin Matheson-Turner. If you like what you heard, share it with your network. For more information and to access all of our podcasts, events, and publications, visit greaterwashingtonpartnership.com.